Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and happy Shabbat to one and all. Here we're about 2 weeks away from the celebration of Pesach, Matzah, and the Bukkudim. Hello, Captain Kirk. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much. How are you doing?
Yeah. No, I'm doing fine. You know, I was had lunch today with a fellow that made the first year decision not to sacrifice something for Lent. And in the past, had given up wine 1 year, gave up chocolate 1 year, and you said, you know, I've begun to question what I believe and whether or not it's worth anything at all. You know, we talked about it at length, and you know, it's just amazing how bold-faced lies, pagan religious drivel, is woven into the fabric of society where the preponderance of people not only believe the lies, they act upon them. And they see them as good. They see that something is worthy to sacrifice something for Lent, that they're doing something that pleases God, that it's a good thing to do. You know, I told this person, Lent has a legacy that was conceived in the first Babylon, the first kingdom of Babylon, back when the Ninus, known as Nimrod in the Torah, was king, and he was killed because he was a wild hunter. And the story is he was killed by a wild boar, which is why we have the Easter ham. And because he died preceding the number one solar festival in the pagan religion, which was the celebration of Ishtar, when the Sunday, of course, Sunday, closest to the vernal equinox.
Sunday.
Yeah, when Taurus the bull is directly
crossing
behind the crossing over and the equator at noon. That they wept for him for those 40 days because of his tragic death. And of course, then it was on Ishtar when the sun crosses over midday and day and night are equal, that his queen, his wife, claimed that she was impregnated by the sun. So that 9 months later on the winter solstice, that would be Christmas Day, she would give birth to the son of the son of God, making her the mother of God and the queen of heaven, the Madonna with the child. And therein you have Easter, and you have Christmas, and of course the weeping for Tammuz, which was the name given to Nimrod in his divine form, is the basis of Lent. There's no question about it. I mean,
no,
there is
nobody
no informed person in the world can make a reasoned argument against what I've just said. It is absolutely factual. And there is absolutely no basis in the Torah, Prophets, Psalms, or even in the God-forsaken Christian New Testament for Lent, for Easter, or for Christmas.
Correct.
And yet, they're directly out of the pages of the Babylonian religion, and God routinely refers to Babylon as the mother of whores, the mother of religion, as the most detestable thing in the world. And even though the kingdom of Babylon fell a very long time ago, 2,500 years ago, because the legacy of Babylon, which is religion, continues to haunt humanity, at the end of Revelation, and indeed prophetically, Yahweh is lamenting that Babylon continues to prevail and influence not only his people, but humanity at large, until the very last days choose to believe the lie and act upon it. And even, Kirk, when you tell them the truth,
they hate you for it.
Yeah.
Really?
No interest in it.
No, not either no interest or how dare you mess me up out there.
This person told me today that, well, you know, it really doesn't matter. You know, I'll be dead when my soul goes to either heaven or hell, so what do I care? And I looked at them and said, you know what? I went from being extremely involved in Christianity to an agnostic for a number of unanswerable questions that even today I could ask any Christian scholar, any pastor, any priest, and there's not a single one of them that can answer any of these questions. I know the answer to all of them. They can't answer any of them. And one of them is fundamental. In Christianity, as is the case with Islam, all souls either go to heaven or hell.
Yeah.
And yet you point out to this person, if all souls go to heaven or hell, God isn't worth knowing. He's a sadist. Every thinking agnostic and atheist in the world knows this. That a God who would say, submit to me, obey me, capitulate to me, praise me, or I'm going to see to it that you're tortured forever in hell, is sadistic.
Sure.
That God you want to spend time with, that's not a God you want to worship. That God isn't worth knowing. And so if true, you don't want to know that God. And most certainly you don't want to worship that God. And you don't want to spend time with him either. And yet, Kirk, I think the first profound insight of all of the hundreds and hundreds of profound insights that we've developed by more accurately and completely translating Yahweh's Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, was that there are three destinations for human souls, and the vast preponderance of human souls don't go to heaven or hell. They simply cease to exist upon their mortal demise.
Which is quite frankly just the fair option.
Right. And it's only those that have misled others in religion or politics or in the military and have knowingly and deliberately led them astray that suffer the consequence of having done that. And they go to Sheol, which doesn't have any tortures. It's just a lightless place, forever separated from God, with like-minded people, which is a pretty miserable thing to think about, but they're victims.
Yeah,
they don't go to heaven or hell. Their souls simply cease to exist. So I shared this. And I said, I don't really care. You know, I'll be dead.
And that was really
true. And he just wanted to say, come on. How could you not care?
It bothers the mind.
It does. But it is so prevalent. We have been talking about a more complete and accurate translation of Bereshith in the beginning, Genesis, first book of the Torah. 17:1 is and 2, I think we're at 17:2 currently, but 17:2 is the second half of a sentence and 17:1, so you really have to begin there.
Sure.
And just as was the message in 15 when Yahweh met with Abram. 17 maybe even be more profound. Certainly it's equally profound. We had a brief chat before the program began, and you had said that you had diligently studied all the words and their meaning,
right,
from 17.1 through 17.7.
Right, every letter and every word and every sequence they were put together, and it just continues to reinforce everything that's being said. It's kind of staggering, I think. It's a little worse that you wouldn't think have that much impact. Best example is you pick up a Bible and you read 17.1 and is, well, let me read one. Let me read 17.1 to you and show you how simple they translated. It says, Abram said unto him, and when Abram was, not that one, I'm going to go to 17.2, and I will make my covenant between me and thee and will multiply thee exceedingly. That is nice. But it's 17.2. I've got pages of, pages, but I got
And it actually follows. It's part of the and there is a conjunction in the middle of the sentence. 17.1 says, choose of your own
volition
and of your own initiative to walk by yourself the Hittite stem of on Halak in the imperative mood.
Uh-huh.
So choose of your own volition and of your own initiative to walk by yourself towards my presence, la pene ani, and thereby wa enjoy becoming genuinely haya, call imperative on an ongoing basis, and literally perfect.
Yeah,
eternally without defect.
That is, and versus what they just skim over.
Right. Continually and entirely right. Completely innocent and totally fulfilled, lacking nothing throughout the whole of time. Now, that's not what you're going to read in either King James, your New King James, your NLT, your New American Standard. It's just not what they convey.
Now, you've got about 30 choices in English, and I've read them all. And that's... They just pretty much copy each other or twist a little word here and there or add a little something.
Do you think it's a single one? I couldn't find a single one to pick up the nuances of the Hittite stem. Hittite stem means that no outside influences. You're doing this on your own.
Directly to you. Yes.
You are self-motivated here. You're not being influenced by anyone. You've made this decision on your own, and you're engaging independently. And, of course, the imperative mood, 90% of the time it's used, maybe 95% of the time it's used, it is second-person volition.
Mm-hmm.
Choose of your own volition. And yet, well, there's no disputing either of those two things. One English translation that picks up on any of them, on either of them.
Right.
And if you don't convey choose of your own initiative, and ascribe that to walk, haven't you lost the, I would say, 80% of the meaning?
Sure. Well, even the word covenant is based on an agreement between two people based on an action they're going to take. And that puts it in the context of this is the action you are to take, and you have to do it. And in regard, it's not a command. It's something you have to choose to do. I mean, so that's rich with all those ideas to explain exactly what you're saying. So, but not a single translator will do it.
No, and of course, tamim is one of those magical words, and that's the final word in the opening phrase of that initial sentence in 17.1. So, the Passover lamb, Yahweh says, must be tamim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't typically have black sheep in our homes, but you and I have enjoyed dogs. A dog is about the most perfect animal you could ever have. They're just loving, they're supportive, they're family oriented, they're as reliable as they could possibly be. They're fun loving. A dog is a really wonderful creature. About as perfect as an animal can be. Cute, cuddly, playful, loves to be around and support their people. Mm-hmm. And yet there's no such thing as a perfect dog. And you told me you had your dog decide that eating berries that were laden with arsenic would be delectable. And if you hadn't figured it out, the vet hadn't figured it out, the dog would have been dead.
Sure.
That was hardly a perfect behavior. But the animal's not bad.
No. He just ate what's going.
Right. And now you're dealing with a sheep, and the sheep are pretty friendly, docile animals. They're not at the league of dogs in terms of their intelligence or their desire to be around and support people. But they live outside. They have all manner of gnats and flies and ticks and that sort of thing that attack them. They lay down in the ground. They're covered with dirt. They never take a bath. There is no such thing as a perfect lamb.
No.
And yet Yahweh says, I want a perfect lamb. Now, is he nuts and that there is no such a thing and he's just not aware of it?
No, hardly.
Hardly. No, the perfect has nothing to do with the animal being perfectly clean, having perfectly white wool, and in terms of its, I guess, wool is a hair, or I think it's a hair, isn't it? It's not about it having, not having bow legs and having perfect knees and perfect joints and perfect bones and perfect internal organs. No. It's what the whole notion of being right. Pick a lamb that's really right.
Yeah.
It's about recognizing that lamb is symbolic of someone who is right.
Yes.
It was lacking in nothing. Well, there's only one person who is absolutely right and lacking in nothing.
Okay.
The author of the Torah text we're reading.
Oh, yeah.
He is absolutely right. At our very best, we fixate on elements of things that are right.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the best we can do it. And even the most right person who ever lived, Zadok, Dode, known to most people as David, he was the inverse from a human perspective of perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, as he said, I've got a lot of stuff wrong. But from God's point of view, he was Zadok right, which equates to Tamim.
Perfect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's the whole thing there is symbolic of the one who is totally fulfilling. Lacking nothing throughout the whole of time, always right. So the perfect is, you're looking for a lamb that is to represent the one who is perfect and lacking nothing, who is always right. Do you have one?
Yeah.
But when he says, I'm going to make you perfect in this statement, what he's saying is, in essence, I'm going to make you like me.
Yeah,
I'm going to make you like me.
Light. Perfect.
Right, I'm going to make you like me.
Mm-hmm.
Light is perfect. Darkness is imperfect. Where there is light, there is no darkness. It isn't, a lot of things we think about that get rid of that which is bad. Erase it or block it out or exonerate it or excuse it. No, in the presence of light, there is no darkness. Light and darkness are not just the opposite of one another. Where there is light, there is no darkness. Darkness disappears, gone.
Yeah.
And so Yahweh is light. Where he is, there is only perfection. He is making us like him. And that's just the first part of the sentence in 17:1. It gets better. So that, I can choose. Now this is Yahweh, because this is the cohortative. The cohortative mood is an expression of first person volition. Now you're never going to find that in any of your translations either, but look up Hebrew grammar. Cohortative is an expression of first person volition. It can mean because it's my will, because this is what I desire, because this is what I have chosen, because this is what I want. Volition can be expressed in any of those. Choose, decide, want, desire.
Yeah.
You know, how many times do you hear people say, I want to know God's will for my life? Well, his will would be expressed in the cohortative mood. If he uses the cohortative mood, he is expressing his will. You don't have to want to know his will if he has made a statement of the cohortative mood, because that is a statement of his will.
Yes.
It's not simple.
Everybody missed that one, though.
I don't know how they all missed that. Now, Nathan means to give, to bestow, to offer. You know, when we have children, our whole mindset is to give them everything we can, to give them the best education we can provide, to give them shelter, protection, nourishment, to fill their lives with experiences, to give them every opportunity. That's what Nathan means. When God speaks of my will is to give, then you don't really have to ask what his will is, do you? My will is to give. What is he giving here?
Giving his eternal life.
Yeah, Barethani is what he says.
Well, he's giving
La Nathan Barethani. It's my desire, my will, to give my family-oriented covenant relationship. They want to know God's will for your life is for you to accept the covenant that he is offering. Full stop. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. Maybe as important as any statement in the whole of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. I want you to choose of your own volition and of your own initiative to walk to me so I can make you perfect, so that I can choose to actually and continually give my family-oriented covenant relationship. And it, well, we've already talked about Pesach, because Tamim speaks of the perfect being coming perfect, and Tamim is used to describe the Pesach lamb. It is God's, this when he says, you know, walk to me and become perfect, there's only one path that you can walk to God and obtain perfection. Pesach leading to matzah.
Right.
And the result of Pesach leading to matzah, of eternal life and perfection, is that you're adopted into God's family.
Yeah. Yes.
Isn't that, and that's the result here. Choose to do these things so that I can choose, so that my will can be fulfilled, which is to give you my family covenant relationship. I can adopt you into my family.
Mm-hmm.
Get to become sons and daughters of the Almighty. You know, what's interesting is bereth is such a powerful word. It means home.
Mm-hmm.
It means household. It means agreement. It means family. It means pledge. It's a contractual arrangement between parties. It's a binding oath, a treaty. It's a marriage vow.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, if you look up bereth in Strong's, which is the only really one of the lexicons that gives you the root,
mm-hmm.
this one they, I mean, I don't know how they missed it, but they give the root of bereth as bana, if you look up in Strong's. And bana is a wonderful word. I like bana. Bana is a verb in Hebrew, and it means to build. And because bana is a B-N-H, it speaks specifically of building a family, building the family name, reestablishing the family, reestablishing the family name. And so there's a lot of bana that oozes through our understanding of family and home with bereth. So I don't have a problem with the association, particularly since BN is the bereth is the family home, and N is the sperm in terms of a child, and the hay is a person standing up, reaching up to God, growing up as a result of being part of the family. So I mean, it's a marvelous word, one of my favorites. And even in Hebrew, they ben, the first two letters, mean son. But what is missed here is that Bereth is obviously based on Be'eth. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out Bereth is Be'eth with one letter added.
Yes.
The Rosh.
Mm-hmm.
Be'eth is
person.
Yeah, B-Y-T-H, as opposed to R-Y-T-H. So all you have, the only difference between family and home, Be'eth, and Bereth is an observant and thinking individual who uses their eyes to see and their ears to hear and their minds.
Engaging their senses, yes.
Mm-hmm. So it's not hard to figure out. And while I don't have a problem with the word covenant, but unfortunately, you know, the Christians will tell you that, well, theirs is the new covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And they get new covenant because it's only mentioned apart from the Pauline rubbish. You know, Paul has the old covenant is pornographic, according to Paul. It's enslaving, it's mean, it's all these horrible things. And it has no chance of saving. So from his point of view, there is a new covenant. Well, he's the only one that has a new one. And, of course, who was Paul's attaché, Paul's historian, Paul's propagandist?
Lucas.
Yeah, Lucas. Yeah, the Roman, whose Latin names mean light-bearer, Lucas.
Well, if Yahweh was so cruel, what did Yahweh do to Abram versus what did the Lord
do to Paul what Yahweh did on behalf of Abram? Sounds pretty cool to me.
I'll take that deal.
But Lucas is the only one that writes New Covenant. You know, when Yosha is fulfilling Pesach, and he's explaining the correlation between himself as the Pesach lamb and the blood, which is represented by the wine, and the broken bread, which is represented by matzah. And, of course, Christians screw that up and call it the Last Supper, and he's celebrating matzah, and Pesach and matzah. And he is equating himself with the Pesach lamb. And the two eyewitness accounts, Matanyah and Yahochanan, this is the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, in Lucas, Paul's historian and attaché, this is the new covenant. So, guess what? Two of those fellows were there.
Yeah. One of them was not.
One of them was not. Two of them agree. One does not. The two agree also happen to agree with God.
Yeah.
The other does not. The one who does not agree with God and does not agree with the two who were eyewitnesses and were there just so happens to agree with the fellow that God called the plague of death.
Yeah. Who went by the name of Sheol, by the way.
Yeah, Sheol.
Separation.
Yeah, which is the place of separation from God.
Mm-hmm.
So, while covenant is a fine term, unfortunately, it has been hoodwinked and shipwrecked and bedazzled by Christians to create a false impression that there is the old covenant and the new covenant. God doesn't have an old covenant or a new covenant. He just has a covenant.
Yeah, well, he made a mistake when he put that Olam in there, too, on so many things.
Yeah, it's an eternal, everlasting covenant.
Lasting
always
covenant,
singular. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not going to become new, as the English translations of Yirmiyah 31 would suggest. It is going to be renewed.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting is all you have to do is read the next line. And the line that precedes it and the line that follows it as it relates to covenant. First of all, it is being renewed with two group of people that are the antithesis, the opposite of Gentiles in their church.
Yes.
The preceding statement says it's being renewed with Yisrael and Yahuda. Uh-oh. If you're a Christian, it can't be your New Testament because you're a bunch of Gentiles. The antithesis of Yisrael and Yahudim. You are screwed, blued, and tattooed if you just read the preceding statement. And the statement that follows says that the basis of it, the only difference between it, is I'm going to write my name in your heart.
Mm-hmm.
My name would be Yahweh. Yeah, not Christian. Yahweh.
Yeah.
And I'm going to place my Torah, my teaching inside of you. Well, if he's going to put his teaching inside of you, you sure as hell can't have a new covenant because the Torah presents the one and only covenant.
Yeah.
It's one of those examples that shows just how stupid, how ignorant, how irrational you have to be a Christian.
Well, it doesn't bother me if somebody wants to believe a lie. What is odd is when confronted with the facts, you know, make your choice, but why tie it to the Torah?
Yeah. Why pretend like Christianity and Islam do? That somehow the Torah validates your religion when in fact it's the antithesis of it.
Yeah, so if you've got so much validation, take your own show on the road and leave the Torah alone.
Right. Yeah, if you want to be Paul and you want to create a religion, do it on your own.
Yeah, but preach your own.
Well, the problem is, of course, if you do that, you don't have any credibility. No one's going to believe you. It's like Muhammad. If Muhammad didn't claim that his Torah, I mean his Quran, confirmed the Torah, and that he was speaking to the same God of Abraham and David and the like, and Adam and the like, he'd have no credibility. No one would have believed his rubbish. The same thing with Paul. He claimed to speak for God, which is the only reason he was credible. And no one bothered to say, wait a minute, every word he wrote is the antithesis of what God said. Same thing is true with Muhammad and the Quran. I mean, the premise is, well, stupid, ignorant, wrong.
And it still flies, though. So, obviously, people must dislike Yahweh.
Well,
I mean, what is it? They just Hashem, you know, they just can't stand there anti-Semitic. They don't like his name. They don't like his plan.
That is correct.
What's not to like about this plan? We've been going over it for several weeks now. I mean, it's a marvelous plan. What's a better plan?
That's my view.
Forgive me. Go ahead.
Well, so here it says, so that I can choose to actually and continually give my covenant relationship, which is my family-oriented covenant relationship, my home, family agreement, my pledge, my contractual arrangement, my binding oath, my marriage vow, for the purpose of understanding by making connections between you and me. Bien ani wa ata, wa bien ata. I don't know if there is a Hebrew word more important than Bayan.
Yeah.
B-Y-N or B-A-Y-N, either way. What word is more important than that?
Well, nothing, because if you can't understand the covenant, then it's of no value to you. I mean, it's all about discernment, understanding, and being able to distinguish between two or more things. So if you can't do that, if you can't understand, all the knowledge in the world won't help you. There's a lot of, as you often say, and it's been my experience, there's a lot of brilliant people in the world, but if they can't understand, they can't grasp it, what it really means, then all that information is just like an encyclopedia sitting on the shelf.
Correct. Now, bien is the Hebrew word for making connections. It means between things. Now, making, associating things, connecting them, bringing them together. And as a beyond just the prepositional nature of the primary definition of the word means to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so being actually explains the process of understanding. You make connections by bringing things together. You make connections. When you make connections, when you create the proper associations, just like we did, the association between Bayreuth and Bayeth, the association between Nathan giving and what fathers do on behalf of their children. When you make those kinds of connections, then you transition from knowing to understanding. That's what Ban means. He says, so this whole thing that I'm offering you is for the purpose of understanding. Nothing is more empowering. Nothing is more enlightening. Nothing is more enriching. I don't think it's any more enjoyable. And if the understanding pertains to coming to know the creator of the universe, engaging in an eternal relationship with him, and coming to understand the nature of light, the nature of life, the purpose of life, and the purpose of the universe, well, those are some pretty important connections and some extraordinarily important understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, the purpose of my covenant, and the reason I want to give it to you, is for you to understand by making connections between you and me. God is not saying, you know, because I really want you to understand the concept of relativity.
No.
Because I want you to understand the mindset of politicians. Because I want you to understand world economics. No. The purpose of this gift of the covenant is because I want you to understand by making connections between you and me. That's the connection that matters.
Yeah. He's only interested in this relationship with you.
Right.
All the rest
so it's not just understanding who Yahweh is. It's not just understanding who we are. It's about understanding the connections that Yahweh wants to make between us. He's defined covenant. He's defined what family is all about. And he says, once you come to understand my purpose, which is to make connections between you and me, then I will continually increase every aspect of your nature to the greatest extent and highest degree possible. Rabbah. Ba meod meod.
I spent a lot of time on those two words because it's so pathetic in the translations in the normal English dictionary. I mean, normal English translations. And Rabbah is easy, you know, becoming great or multiple or exponential growth. You'll find increasing wisdom and power and authority. Which is, if obviously that would happen because if we become like him, then we're going to be like him, you know, and he's the Almighty.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the words, and the same thing applies there. So you've got a Rosh or a Resh looking at a bet, the family home, observing the family relationship in essence. And the result is the hay at the end, which is engaging, standing up, continuously looking, continually observing. And then when you go meod, meod, or just the meod by itself even, is exceedingly abundant. It's a magnitude of degree. It's an infinite degree from Oud, a brand. And this is interesting. I found one of the connected words, and this is what I was talking about off before we began the show, is that I went down this little connection of all these different related words. And it took me to, from Oud, it went to Odah, and as a related word. And that's, it just usually is translated concerning or because of, on account of.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, in the original meaning, an abundant remnant of charred wood from afar that is raked together, causing a cloud of ash. And I thought, well, gosh, how does that connect? And then I started thinking, well, there's if I fast forward to the future time events that we're living in that are about to take place, you've got destruction of the earth and the remnant raised up from a charred world. You've got dew, and I may be stretching a little bit, but that's just what came to mind when I was trying to figure out why that's, if all that's related, and due to the recognition of the relationship offer of the Yom Kippurim. And then you could have a marked interest and regard arising through a personal tie or relationship, a turning over or bringing together of a thought, which is what you, is what basically means in this context would be someone accepting the covenant contract, the covenant agreement.
Right.
So what was interesting to me, and I may be all wet, and it's okay if you know, you say that's too much, but all these little connecting words that you don't think are have much to say, from this one to this one to this one, they all give you a little glimpses into the same thing that he's talking about, and I just found that fascinating.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this point of view. Ed, uh-huh. which would be the last, because there's three letters. The ma, water, the LF, and the left. The
what?
Three letters. Ed, when it's vocalized as Ed, or odd. Odd means eternal.
Mm-hmm.
So, odd is eternal. Ed is testimony or witness.
Right.
So, same two letters, depending on how they're vocalized, are either testimony and witness, or eternal and everlasting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the ma before it tells us that we should seek answers regarding, that we should search for the meaning of, that we should want to know the who, what, why, whom, and where. So, it's to question the who, what, where, how. Of the everlasting testimony.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just break it down into its two components, any word that that is a conjunction of the ma idea, the mem, mm-hmm. followed by whatever follows it, means for you to seek understanding and to question the meaning, try to discern the who, what, why, where, and how. Of, in this case, add or ed the everlasting and eternal witness or testimony.
Yeah. Well, even simplistically to me, I had the Aleph Waw delete, or ed, and you've got Yahweh increasing the family. So the same subject we're talking about.
Right.
So
so what John was saying here is that if he gives us the covenant, understanding and making connections between himself and us, then he's in a position to continually increase every aspect of our nature to the greatest extent and the highest degree possible based upon the who, what, why, where, and when of his eternal witness.
Mm-hmm.
Really powerful statement, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's the whole function or purpose of the covenant. And why Yahweh wants us to walk to him of our own volition, independently, so that he can make us perfect.
Go ahead. All due respect to all these different fields of learning, and I like learning, so I'm not the enemy of. But if you didn't Shemar Torah, if you didn't start there trying to figure out what these words mean in their fullness,
mm-hmm.
to the best of your ability, mine's not great, but I'm getting there, I think, a little bit each time. How would you, all that other knowledge doesn't help me very much. You know, I know a lot about light from the standpoint of a two-dimensional, how you depict it and stuff, and I've taken science classes and grasped of real basic fundamentals, and that's wonderful, but I would have never thought very deeply about it the way I have become just by reading the Torah and trying to understand Yahweh and what he can do and how it all works and how you can...
And how he equates to light and how he's equating us to light.
Right, exactly. And how, yeah, even if you just talk about a malacca, how they show up from here to here and to a different dimension and so forth. Yeah. It's just,
if you were to look at this too, isn't it a bit like E equals MC squared and Einstein's theory of relativity? Where Einstein was the first to really understand the fundamental nature of the universe with E equals MC squared. Mm-hmm. Energy, which is light, is equivalent to matter or mass times the square of the velocity of light, which means that we as material beings are infinitesimal compared to energy. You have to multiply what we are by the speed of light times the speed of light to reach the point where it's equivalent to energy. When Yahweh transforms us mortal beings into light, it's based upon E equals MC squared, and that you get, if you have that understanding, all of a sudden you've got an idea of what he means by saying, I will continually increase every aspect of your nature to the greatest extent and highest degree possible. Because it's not just this transition from the minimus matter to extraordinary energy and light in the E equals MC squared equation. He's also taking us from 3D past 4D, where we're infinite in time, past 5 dimensions, past 6 dimensions, into 7. And with each dimensional increase, you're dealing with an infinite increase.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the difference between flatland, 2 dimensions, and 3 dimensions is infinite. Just as it's an infinite increase from 3 to 4, 4 to 5, 5 to 6, and ultimately 6 to 7. That's the kind of ma'od, ma'od, rabah that Yahweh is offering. That's what he wants to do for us. He wants to empower, enrich, enlighten, educate, stimulate, expand, magnify, empower, prolong his covenant children. The purpose of the covenant. Now, God wouldn't be much of a father if he didn't make us eternal.
Mm-hmm.
And how would he relate to us in an enjoyable manner, and we would relate to him if he didn't bridge the gap between us? So that
we would get very old, don't you think? Coming to Earth trying to, as a set apart this and a more set apart that. I mean, he would like us to look him in the eye, so to speak. I mean, those terms that I can understand. But I mean, you'd want him to come over to your home sometime, not just a place where we get together on the Earth as matter. So he'd have to convert us to light, and we'd have to, in order to enjoy our company.
Yeah. It's like if we were to decide that we wanted to form a family of viruses. You know, viruses are little ugly things that are manipulations poison animals. But they're a little bitty tiny thing compared to us. So they really don't have brains. Don't really have a nervous system. They're closer to us than we are to God.
Okay. Very nice.
And it's like us trying to say, you know what I want to do is I want to create a family of viruses. I want to create a family of bacteria. I want to create a family of amoebas.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, how much fun is that going to be? You ever try to talk to an amoeba?
No, sir.
I mean, no. You know, I want to create a family. Let's go way up the evolutionary tree and let's say I want to create a family of mice.
Oh.
Okay, well, they're cute enough, you know. They're not biting you. They're not disease-ridden. They're not dying on you. They're not pooping on you.
Yeah.
You know, I guess they're okay. But how long are you going to engage with a family of mice before you say, can't talk to them, they can't talk to me. I can't reason with them, they can't reason with me. I really can't do anything for them. I feed them, all they do is poop. If I don't feed them, they die. Even if I feed them and they poop, they eventually die.
Eventually die, too.
Yeah, you know, if I try to hug them, they bite me. couldn't make the amoeba or the mouse, if you will,
yeah,
more like you, so that it had the same understanding, the same insights, the same capacity, then what fun would it be? And even, you know, as much as we love dogs, you know, a dog is a huge step up in the animal kingdom. Yeah, well, you can talk to the dog can communicate back with you. But the daggone dogs, you know, after about 10 to 15 years, they die on you.
Yeah.
And it's really, really, really painful.
Yes.
So wouldn't you, naturally, if you're God, you're going to have a relationship, you've got to make the being that you're having a relationship more like you, and you've got to make them immortal?
Yeah.
Well, especially so you were pained when your dog ate the arsenic.
Oh,
so
yeah,
you've got to make the being such that it doesn't pain you.
Sure.
More perfect. More capable.
Well, if you think in terms of Yahweh's 6 days, the whole universe was in 6 days, 15 and a half billion years, or 14.7, or whatever we decide it is going to be, and someday if we ever figure that out while we're here, of our lifespan, of the lifespan is only 6 days to him. That ain't much fun for him when you think how long man's been on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So if he doesn't, I don't care if he stays no 1,000 years, ain't nothing, it won't be much to him.
Yeah, and no, Homo sapiens, 100,000 years or so.
Yeah, probably 80,000 years since whatever.
Yeah, it depends on who you, where you look. You know, recently the oldest Homo sapien fossils were found in Israel, and they were part of that. You're dealing with Homo erectus, and they're man-like, but not Homo sapien. Yeah, but Homo sapien about 100,000 years. Some say closer to 200,000 years. It's kind of how you date things, where you find them, where you draw your lines. But so I don't care. You know, use 100,000 or 200,000. You know,
we're very brief.
Yeah, the planet's been here for what, 4-point-something billion years,
mm-hmm,
and the universe has been here for 14 or more billion years?
15, depending.
Yeah, depending, yeah. And again, we can't even value, quantify this because you got two issues. We really don't have a full grasp of the temperature of quark confinement, and time did not flow prior to quark confinement. You have to make the transition from energy to matter for there to be time as we know it. So to say, you know, it was X number of years ago, well, X number of years ago requires an orderly flow of time, and time does not manifest itself in flow until there is matter, and matter doesn't exist until quarks are confined. Otherwise, it's just energy. And so one of the issues with the 13.8 billion year time frame is that there are three very equally valid assessments of quark confinement. They used the shortest of the three, or the lowest of the three, where the middle range is I think 14.8, very close to 15 billion years, probably more accurate, but no one really knows. And then you've got the issue of, well, the universe existed as light in a super hot phase before quarks were confined. And all we can do is try to trace back time from the point of the cooling to quark confinement and not beyond that. So we don't know, and we have no way of knowing. But we can discern this, that it was 6 24-hour days from reckoning of somebody at creation, which is somewhere between 14 and 15 billion years.
Mm-hmm.
As time would move from our point of view, including the time before a quark confinement when light was the only thing that existed. But that's what Yah was offering. You know, if you want to know what he's offering, what he wants, what his will is to give the covenant, make you part of his family. And the reason for that is that he wants your understanding to grow relative to the relationship between he and us. And once that happens, he's in a position to magnify us, expand us, empower us, enrich us beyond comprehension. Mayot, mayot. All based upon the who, what, why, where, when of his eternal witness. Which, by the way, is comprised of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Full stop.
Amazingly enough.
The very books that we are reading. Now, I've made the statement a lot of times before, and I want to reemphasize it here. And for those that get mad at me for this, then so be it. But I don't think Abraham was the smartest dude around. I think that part of God's choosing people to engage with is that he specifically looks for the opposite of what you would think. You know, if God's going to present the most profoundly important idea in the history of humanity, you'd think he'd find the sharpest guy, right?
Yeah.
That wasn't Abraham. He was not smart. And we're going to read what he did after all of this. It says he was not smart. Now, you know, if you wanted to convey the perfection of the Torah, the last thing you'd do is pick a guy that had more faults than he had hair on his head, like Dode. You want to pick the guy that's going to correctly announce your name and your purpose to the world and convey your teaching. Mm-hmm. You're going to pick the most articulate guy going. And yet, Moshe stuttered.
Yes.
So I think that in this case, Abram was cast not only because he was the only person willing, but because he wasn't the sharpest tool on the carry bags on that donkey they were riding out of Babel. Mm-hmm. Then Abram fell. The fall. Collapsed. Lay down. Falling as a result of being negligent. On his face. So, God spoke to influence him. Dabar eth hu. Communicated, expressing statements, and had words concerning him, putting him into action and changing his approach based upon what was said. Deal, stem, and imperfect conjugation, where the object, Abram, suffered the full effect of the verb and was put into a different position through the action of an ongoing basis with unfolding consequences. Boy, those talk about a stem being important. Peel is really important here. Then Abram fell on his face. So God spoke to influence him, to put him into a different position for the purpose of encouraging him, and said, La Amar, Anehena, pay attention and look up at me. Henna has two hays in it. Are the hays a person laying down on their schnoz, their nose in the dirt?
No, they're active and standing up and in a behold type of position, pointing upwards, reaching upwards.
Hay and then a hay.
Take their part. Right. That means they're active, they're walking, they're engaged.
Right. Hay and then a hay. The hays are two people standing up, reaching up to God, and the nen in the middle of it is a child, the birth of a child, a sperm.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, nena, hey, look up, stand up, pay attention, listen to me, become observant, behold, here I am, calling your attention to the details of this narrative, emphasizing the idea that you should change your perspective and your view regarding me. You want to know me? Look up to me. Don't look down. You aren't going to find me in the dust between your toes. You aren't going to see me if your eyes are in the dirt. Anna, look up. Stand up. Pay attention. My family covenant relationship is with you, et ata, and shall be accordingly, and you shall be accordingly, father, of an abundantly enriched and magnified, but also troublesome and uproarious, Hamon, group of Gentiles. Hamon, very wealthy and substantially enhanced. But I would certainly speak of us, wealthy in all the matters that that mean anything with God, enriched, substantially enhanced, exceedingly amplified and multiplied, but also a great number of enraged and confused, turbulent and tumultuous, especially wealthy and loud-mouthed goyim, populations of people, nations of shared ethnicity or geography who are non-Israelites. But you know, that those who would claim to be the beneficiaries of the religion of Abraham, use this verse, all Christians, and Muslims. Muslims, and most rabbinic Jews.
Yes.
Right. Now, the first two of those represent, what, 3+ billion people? And the second, 4 to 4.5 billion people?
Possibly.
I would call that an abundant number.
That is one.
The Gentiles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, from God's point of view, they're uproarious, they're troublesome. They're enraged, they're confused, they're turbulent, they're tumultuous.
Yes.
A lot of them are wealthy, and many of them are loudmouthed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two groups. There's a small group of goyim who have been enriched and empowered, and magnified by God had to say, and what he offered to Abram, and there's a whole lot of them.
Well, you know,
troublesome.
I did a lot with this one as well, only because it has so many negative overtones. There's not a Bible anywhere that's going to present this side of the equation.
Right.
You know, these are goy. These are people, you know, it's like, okay, well, we're goy, therefore, and we like Jesus, so we can be part of the family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or whatever they say anymore. But he's talking about some real negative. Most of these words are really negative.
Right.
I mean, it's a roar, and people who destroy the animal or persons that roar, trouble, confusion, destroyers. I mean, just to name a few, people...
Enraged and corpse.
I mean, he's talking about some really heavy-duty negative stuff. And
yeah,
he's talking
there's
about...
There's far more negative associated. Yeah, far more negative with Hamon than there is positive. Now, a lot of Hebrew words have a positive and negative side, a dark and light side. Well, Hamon is like 80% dark and 20% positive.
Right.
It's the antithesis of Anna. You know, Anna is the word that the religious community has taken the negative side to afflict, to humiliate, to debase. When the primary meaning of Anna, and 80% of the time it is used to answer and respond, which are very positive things. Somebody makes a God here, makes an offer, and you answer and respond to the invitation that he's offered. And yet, so Anna is one of those words that's 80% positive in its usage and 20% negative, maybe even 90-10. Well, Hamon... it's just the opposite.
Yeah.
It tells you that the vast majority of those who would claim lineage from Abraham are troublesome. They're enraged, they're confused, they're tumultuous, they're loud-mouthed.
I've even found loud noise as from the sea. That was really good when he describes the sea of Muslims coming on the sea.
Yeah, the sea of Gentiles. Yeah, because there's also a veritable floods of Muslims that are coming into Israel in the last days. And so this notion that the covenant as formed with Abraham was somehow something that God formed with the Jews, and then he has a new covenant with the Gentiles. Well, that's pretty much the part of thunder was it. Yeah. Because God's saying that as a result of this covenant relationship, I'm going to either abundantly enrich and magnify, or it's going to cause lots of trouble for Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
For goyim.
Yeah.
That means this covenant is indeed something for goyim. And you know, We have a lot of ethnic Jews, Israelites, Yehudim, who have read Yad Yah and who've read Observations for Our Time and Introduction to God, listen to this program, and they would not consider themselves Goyim. But you know, they are in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're estranged from Israel as it exists today.
It's still the same one door for everybody, including them.
Right. But they really are. They don't live in Israel.
No.
They're not Israelis. And Israelis fall typically into two categories. There are the agnostic / atheist secular Israelis, and there are the dumber than snot religious Israelis. And it's about 80-20. Probably in Israel it's a higher percentage of religious. Worldwide it's about 80-20. In Israel it's probably 70-30. Secular versus religious, sectarian. And the Israelites, descendants of Israel, that are living outside of Israel, who have chosen to be part of the covenant, they're really not part of Israel. They are, and to a large degree, Goyim. They really are. I mean, they're not Israel as Israel exists today. There is Yisrael as God intended it to be. There Yahudim as God intended it to be, but aren't we?
Well, he clarifies that in his passages. I mean, it's for anyone who agrees to the same terms and conditions, and that's the adoption process.
Correct. So he says, and with regard to your name, Abram. You would think that if God's going to make a difference between his name and mine, I'm only aware of a couple of people where God changed their name, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jacob became Israel.
Right.
Abram became Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's maybe that I missed some. I'm sure there's probably some others that God changed their name, but I can't think of any right off the top of my head.
Oh, Sarah.
Who else did God change their name?
Sarah, but that's part of the family, too. I mean, part of the
family. Oh, yes, that's right. Well, Sarah is the... She went from Sarai to Sarah. You're right.
Sarah.
So she... And, of course, that isn't exactly the same context here. In fact, Jacob becoming Israel is the same context.
Same context, yes.
Yeah, I mean, Jacob becomes the father of Israel, and Israel is Yahweh's family, the chosen people. And, of course, they are descendants of Abraham and Sarah. So it's those are the three names that he changes, right? So here he is, with regard to your name. Now, if God's going to take a name that's important, and, you know, Abram means is from Ab and Rum, father who raises and lifts up, father who grows and increases, father who enhances someone's capability and status, providing added aptitude, competency, and proficiency, increasing dimensionality, taking them to a higher place. That's a pretty good name, Abram.
Mm-hmm.
Rum is a good word. Means father, and Rum is very powerful. So if he's going to change that name, and he's talking about this being his will for us to empower us through the covenant, we ought to pay attention to that. We ought to say, you know, this name is going to be important. And he announces the change of name by using a verb that's got to be in the top 10 most important in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. You don't have to know a lot about Hebrew to know this word is really important, kara.
Yeah.
Remember we spoke also about ode? Well, this is lo kara ode. And it will no longer be called out. You know, kara means to invite, to summon, to designate, to proclaim.
Recite. Yeah.
Recite, to read, to testify. And ode is an eternal witness. Very powerful concept. So, and with regard to Abram, it will no longer be called out, but instead, your name, Shem, shall come to exist as Haya, Abraham. This is Ab, from father, and Abba, showing a willingness to accept either the addition of an H to room, to lift up, Hamon, to abundantly enrich, or a large population of confused and uproarious individuals, are Rakam, merciful and loving. So, with Ab, father, you have Abba, willingness to accept, room, to lift up, Hamon, abundantly enrich, or Rakam, merciful and loving. My view is that shades of all of those are in it. For the reason, and to show a contrast, key, because surely to designate an exception through causation and to imply an alternative, as the Father abundantly enriched and magnified, but also a multitude of troublesome and uproarious Gentiles, I have caused to be appointed through you, Nathan App. So I'm going to change your name. Yeah, for these reasons. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, nobody would get that unless there was someone like you looking up these words. I mean,
are you?
It didn't happen all these years, so where is it? I'm looking right now. I can't find it in any of the chat, you know.
No.
No.
No. And why would you pass over something
important
about
the story? The most important story is wiped out.
Right. Why would God change his name unless there was a reason to do so? Unless there was something he was trying to teach us?
He always teaches. That's the first thing you go to. What's he trying to teach me?
Yeah. Abram and Abraham, they're pretty close, but there is a difference. And what is the difference? Adding the hay to room?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly what the man's doing.
Yeah. Yeah, willingness to accept either the addition of the H-A room to lift up Hamon, abundantly enriched, or a large population of confused and uproarious individuals, and Rakam, merciful and loving. Now, personally, I think that it is the Rakam, even though the hay, it's a hay instead of a, the che, it's not the soft H, not the hard H, but it's a compound word. So, and the difference, of course, in Babylonian Hebrew, not so much in the Paleo Hebrew, but in the Babylonian Hebrew, between the he and the che is really tiny, and on particularly on papyrus, it become almost indistinguishable. It's whether or not the left upright of what a letter that kind of looks like a table, you know, it's got the two. In Babylonian Hebrew, anyway, it's got the tabletop and the two legs that come down. It's whether or not in both of them, the right leg touches the top of the table, but in the
other one doesn't. Yeah,
and the left leg, one does and the other one doesn't. And so there isn't, you know, when you're dealing with the kinds of quills that were used and the kinds of stains that were used for ink and the rough nature of papyrus, many, many thousands of years before paper was invented. In fact, the first copies of this would have been on parchment, on animal skins, and then later on papyrus. Paper wasn't even invented until the 4th century CE. That's a distinction that's easily lost. So, you know, I'm not here to dictate that it's one of these things or the other, but it did change. We've added a hay to the room. That's basically the only difference in Abram and Abraham is there's a hay in the before the mem. It's really that's the only difference. And so, what's the hay mean there?
Still the observant, engaged person.
Correct. And in this case, because it's not the end of the word, it would be masculine.
Right.
A person standing up, reaching up to God. And so it could be the father of those who stand up and reach up to God, who are lifted up and enriched, becoming more abundant, and who receive mercy. All of those are possible. And that's kind of the nice thing about so many things, that we don't have a perfect answer here. I prefer it that way. I can't be dogmatic. I don't think you can be after your research and say, the change from Abram to Abraham, therefore, negates this and adds that. Best we can do is to say, Abram is from Ab and Rum. That's really straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
And Abraham conveys room to uplift, but with a uplifting the purpose of standing up and reaching up to God. Then it conveys part of Hamon, which is both light and dark, to abundantly enrich or to be confused. And we're calm, merciful, and loving.
I love you.
Take your pick. Some of all of those things?
I go to all of the above.
Yeah,
can't apply.
Yeah. So, starting at the beginning, and with regard to your name, Abram, it will no longer be called out, Kara. But instead, your name shall come to exist as Abraham. For the reason, and to show a contrast. So, we're told that the change is for a reason. It's to show a context. It's to designate an exception through causation.
Yeah, because.
Because. As the father of Hamon, of abundantly enriched and magnified, but also a multitude of confused and troublesome Gentiles, I have caused this to be appointed through you, Nathan. And man, you know, you look up today, you Google religion of Abraham. Well, you know, Abraham did not have a religion. He didn't even have faith. He had a covenant relationship with Yahweh. Those who will usurp his name, you know, the Quran claims to be the religion of Abraham. Judaism claims to be the religion of Abraham. Christianity claims to be the religion of Abraham, even though he didn't have a religion. And you can think of the people that are confused and uproarious and troublesome, who have claimed their lineage through this man.
Yeah.
Boy, is it ever apparent. And yet, 100% really of those who have been enriched by Yahweh, Gentiles and Yahudim alike, 100% of those who have been empowered and enriched by Yahweh have been enriched as a result of this covenant relationship as has been presented through by Yahweh to Abraham. That's the only way that Yahweh has ever enriched anyone. And of those people that are most troublesome on earth, the vast majority of those claim that their religion is based upon the legacy of Abraham. That's the pivot point to which the world still turns. Now, extremely insightful, this statement. And it was all began with Henna, too, which is the word that really brought us to this, to understand why God uses Henna as he does. And then as we go to 17:6, and I will enable you to flourish and be fruitful. Para eth atta. Flourish. Fruitful. Productive. Conceive offspring in abundance, creating a plentiful harvest, successive generations, highly productive, to an extraordinary degree and to the highest point measured on any scale. Ma meod meod. Then I will allow and produce through you accordingly Gentiles, nations of people related by geography, ethnicity, politics, and kings who on account of you shall come into being. You know, and there were kings that Yahweh appointed. Solomon, for example. Yeah, Solomon. There's two that Yahweh actually appointed. Yeah. And there were kings that claimed their power as a direct result of being
their lineage.
Derivatives, being the legacy of Abraham, of the Holy Roman Empire, all of Islam.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So that became true. But the most important part of this is the whole purpose of the covenant and for what Yahweh is offering through it is for us to flourish and grow, have productive lives. Very few lives turned out to be as productive as Abraham's. If you were to distill who are the, we talked about this in the last program, who are the most influential and important people in human history? Abraham's in the top five.
He's in the top six.
Yeah, he'd be in the top five.
Yeah.
You got Adam.
Adam, of course.
Noah. Yeah, Abraham. You've got Moshe. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Moshe. And then Noah.
Yeah, Moshe, Noah. Yeah, Yosha.
Who's going to be number seven?
Well, I rather like Yashaya.
That's funny. I'll put that down. That was my favorite.
Yeah.
I was expecting going through Yashaya. We really got
Yashaya. Yeah, I did. But Yashaya down.
He is the main prophet to our time, without doubt.
Yeah, he is.
I know there are others.
Who would have thought that he was the main prophet for our time?
He's got the big scroll.
Yeah. One of the things, too, that's really interesting is that, the beginning of that speaks and condemns religion and speaks of and condemns politics and speaks of and condemns militarism and all of the lies that permeate society. And then people think, well, no, it's really, 9-6. It's talking about Art Jebus. No, it's talking about Dode, David.
Yeah.
And the importance of David, even names him. How'd you miss it? And why is David important? Well, there's two reasons. He's talking about our time. If you want to understand the Torah, if you want to know what it's how to become right with God, the answer is Dode.
Dode's writing.
When Yahweh returns and reestablishes the earth in the condition of the Garden of Eden, whose kingdom is it going to be established in? Whose name?
Dode.
Dode. So Dode is the guy for our time. Yosha's not.
Yeah.
So you're right. Yashaya is the prophet for our time. What were the odds that there's only one book? Out of all the books that comprise the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, there's only one that we have a complete scroll of. It'd be the longest one.
That was my first clue.
It's a pretty good clue, isn't it?
That's a good clue.
Great Isaiah scroll. It's all there.
Yeah. But to your point about understanding, we just went through BN a little while ago about how important that is, otherwise all the information is worthless if you can't understand it. That's the trouble with today's world. They're swamped with information. They can't put it together. And who is the keynote speaker in understanding the Torah? Dode.
Right. And I
don't have a conflict at all with Dode being so important.
No, I don't either.
I don't have a conflict with any of these people being important. They all and what the relationship was with y'all and what they were there for and what they did is all magnificent.
Yeah, it is. Right. And here you got Mayod repeated again, and we've just come to realize that the Ma speaks of the who, what, where, how, and when.
Yeah.
And the Ed Ode is the everlasting testimony. And so it's through the everlasting testimony and our ability to understand the who, what, why, where, and when of it, the how of it, that God's able to make us flourish and to be fruitful and productive. Well, the story of the covenant, story of the Torah. Again, it's one of those statements that if you take the time to dissect it and the letters and the words, You go from something that is trivial to something that's profoundly important,
mm-hmm.
enlightening, enriching, ban, adding to our understanding. So that's the primary purpose of this. And yeah, you know, there's, it's not just that that some will be enhanced and flourish. Well, some are going to go in the opposite direction. God's, it's like everything that Yahweh has to say in the Torah. And everything he had to say through the Yahuwah scroll. There are positives and there are negatives. There's people that accept the Torah teaching and embrace the covenant, and those who reject it. And if, you know, if you listen to the prophet Yeshayah, you have a better way of distilling the meaning here in this contrast here. Because what we learn through Yeshayah is that, you know, Yahweh threw open the door of heaven. Open the door of heaven! There was no one there. And he lamented because there was no one there. And he's condemning Yisrael and Yahudah wholesale because of the universal acceptance of religion and politics and the Gentiles along with it. And speaking of Satan's influence on the Gentiles as a result of all of that. So God is not saying here that the kings who are rule on the account of Abraham are good. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. It's vastly more people have been confused and have become troublesome than those who have been enriched and empowered. And it's a consistent theme through all of this.
Well, I'll give you a positive and negative of the word king that I believe to be true.
Okay.
Malach is, the oldest definition I could find is walking as a king, of a king that we call a king, is walking among the people with counsel and advice. Now that describes the old to a T. He was also described as a shepherd king, very different distinction between that of Amalekite. An Amalekite king was called a king shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
And in the king shepherds, when you read about the king shepherds, they use their flock to fight. It was a strategy. They would use mm-hmm. the herds to attack a town. And when this way, they went into Egypt. They sent those in. They didn't know how much army was left, even though they knew that the big one was destroyed at the by the waters. But they would use that constantly to send in, and you can't fight against a stampeded herd. I mean, we're talking about thousands of animals. So you're helpless there because you're trying to protect your food, you're trying to protect these, get rid of those things, and then the army would come in and destroy the remnants. The view of a king there is he didn't care a thing about his flock other than what it could do for him. Dode, being a shepherd king, he was all about shepherding. He cared intensely about
the flock.
God's children.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a counselor. That's a big difference. I don't care that you call him a king, but I don't get hung up on English words anymore like I used to about what a king means. Well, what does it mean when he talks about Dode as a king?
Well, yeah, we got to look at the word though is Malek. It's not king. It's Malek. And while it can be rendered king, Malek is related to Malak. Malek and Malak are related concepts.
Right.
And Malak means messenger.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is the Malak concept is messenger. And one of the definitions of the underlying reasons that Malek is considered an empowered person is because that person can do as they please.
Sure.
You know, so it's the Malek is the person who can use their free will to do as they please, can do what they want to do. And really, Yahweh's messengers, those who convey his message, are empowered to do as they wish. They're empowered by their free will. So there really is a very positive application of Malek. It is a messenger who has been empowered through the choices that they have made. And it's not just the Shepherd King, which is a very positive insight.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, through Abram, there will be those who are empowered by the choices they have made to become effective messengers on behalf of
the And then there'll be one like King James, Iams. You remember his famous statement to the world was, he's the king, you can do anything he wants.
Right.
And he did, and he wrote his own Bible.
Right, and he did. And you know, and that's the nature of free will.
Why you pick up a King James Bible and not know something about King James and how disgusting it was, beats me.
Yeah. And that's really the beauty of all of this. With free will, we have the choice to accept what Yahweh was offering or to reject it, to convey his message or our own.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the Malek, who serve their own interests, are the antithesis of the Malak, who convey Yahweh's message.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very similar words.
Yeah.
Just, you know, what you do with your choices. Very powerful stuff. Every nuance, every word of all of us. I don't know where you could find something that would be, you know, quite honestly, more powerful than this. And I was just thinking that, you know, after that last statement, would I write like 10 pages, 8 pages of commentary?
Commentary, yeah.
Yeah, I got pretty carried away, but there's a lot to it.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot to be carried away about. I mean, we haven't even moved on to the yo-bells and all that good stuff. There's quite a lot still. There's a lot of meat on this bone.
There is. And you know, we've talked about it for the last couple of 3 weeks, but there is no more important area of Yahweh's testimony than this. You know, a lot of people say, can you just simplify it, shorten it, give me the summary, the executive summary of what the... Well, this is the executive summary. And, you know, guess where you find it?
Yeah.
Right at the beginning. This is the 15th and 17th chapter of the first book. And you know, the kind of stuff that comes before it all sets the table so you're in a position to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand creation and time and why God created. And then you have to understand the conditions in Eden. No religion, no politics, no police, no judges. Just Adam and Yahweh. And what are the kinds of things they did together? Celebrating life. And then why? Yahweh thought it was important for Adam to have Chawa. And this idea that Adam and Chawa together could become mother and father, husband and wife. Have this complete relationship, come to love one another, conceive life, nurture life, living together, sharing life in the garden, leading to Noah, where Noah was the only person who walked away from the town, from the people, from the community of man, and chose to form a relationship with Yahweh, and then listened to what Yahweh had to tell him and acted upon it, did exactly what God said without exception.
Yeah.
And he and his family were the only ones that were saved from in that region within the Salma from the ensuing flood. And how important that is, and how important it is to understand the story of Nimrod and of Babylon and of the confusion of religion, because that's the source of the things we were talking about, of Lent, of Easter, of Christmas. Sunday worship, all of that stuff, the Trinity.
Every Western religion, certainly.
Yeah, the Trinity all comes, the Christian cross, it's all derived from that same story of the confusion and intermixing of Babylon. And to realize that those are the preambles, those are the things that take place prior to the introduction of Abram and his family, which we learned so much about. All walking away from Babylon. And it wasn't just that was the first step. They had to walk away from Babylon to even engage in a relationship with Yahweh. You know, most of the family either never really left or didn't complete the journey.
Yeah.
And so those are the only stories that exist prior to this one. And so that's the preamble so that you at least have the proper perspective on God's reason for everything that follows the covenants. This is a family relationship. This is God's will. It's what he wants to give. And he's expressed the reasons, increase understanding to empower us, to increase us and enrich us in every possible way. So we'll begin next week with, 17.6, I think.
There's 17.6 at the moment, about page 74 for those who are reading the book.
Yeah.
So, I don't think this is, you can get as deep as you want on this stuff. Listen, if I didn't have a chance to know much of anything else, I could start a relationship with Yahweh on this section alone.
Correct.
You know, he did. I mean, he didn't have a whole lot after this.
No,
you know,
Abraham did. Yeah, it was all Abraham had, and it was enough.
Yeah, it was more than enough. But we're so lucky we get to read on and on and on and on and on and on and keep going. But
form a more complete relationship with Yahweh. We can understand far more than Abram did because not only do we have the benefit of Adam and Noah and understanding of Babel on that side. And this whole understanding and a thoughtful consideration of every aspect of what was shared with Abram from beginning to end. But we also have all of the insights that were added by Yahweh's communication through Moshe to Israel. And then we have all of the enlightenment of Dod. And then we have all the prophetic insights regarding our time through Yahshayah. And it goes on and on and on. Yeah, we're in a much better position.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, if you get this, you get the basic tenets, and then the rest of it is just wow, just more wows. It's like an art museum. You go in, you say, oh, that's wonderful, and then you get room after room after room after room to explore. It's kind of like that.
It is.
Great stuff.
Yeah. So many colors in this palette.
Well, I can speak on behalf of most folks. We appreciate you, pal.
Well, thank you. This was fun.
Really?
Thank you, Kirk. Glad your puppy survived the arsenic ingestion. All is good.
All is good.
Talk to you next week, my friend.
All right. Thank you so much. Shalom.
Okay. Shalom.